After all this, you still...
I still want that gas, yes. And you had better deliver.
So, Jimmy's already tackled two of the other 50 states in the Union so far. There's been a sus Kentucky, or Esoteric Kentucky that you did with the Trillbillies. You covered sus Indiana on Program to Chill.
Mm-hmm.
My home state, Michigan, that's something you approached me with, I think, last year. I was reading Thomas Carr's Dark Side of the Mitten, which is a great introduction to a bunch of weird shit that happened in Michigan. And that kind of just spun into a conversation about doing this. So we're going to basically be getting into like a summary and a extended discussion of various parapolitical events and topics that stand out in the Midwest's most iconic state. Yes, this is Illinois and Ohio erasure. So
it's funny, Adi, because I do plan to have a rebuttal that will enshrine Ohio as the susest of states, but I'll set that aside. I have to write it first, and you know, we'll see.
I wouldn't say that Michigan's the most sus. I say it's uniquely posited to be a contender.
Most iconic? Okay, that might. No, maybe.
I guess who's in the top? Well, there's only so many states. I guess who are in the contenders ring for most iconic Midwest state?
Oh, it's definitely those three: Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, for sure.
I always throw Iowa and Minnesota into the mix. Maybe that's just because that's the Midwest nice in me.
Iowa. What do they have? Corn?
Pretty much.
More corn?
Corn and somehow the caucuses. I don't know how they got that.
Yeah. Iowa is extremely sus, but definitely losing the iconic race.
Yeah. Minnesota has like also has this understated influence on culture. You could argue like the fitness craze of the 70s came out of Minnesota. And a lot of gym chains are headquartered in Minnesota as well. Like LA Fitness, Lifetime Fitness, Anytime Fitness, I think all have like corporate headquarters or offices in Minnesota for some reason.
I did not know that.
That was just something I was looking up like a couple years ago. I'm like, what does Minnesota have to do with this? But maybe getting to Michigan, right? Like, what are some common tropes? Or maybe just the overall reputation of Michigan you've observed. You seem like a well-traveled man.
So I used to live in Northwest Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually spent possibly, you know, more time in Michigan than like maybe most Ohioans. I mean, a lot of Ohioans go to Michigan. But like, I probably know more of Michigan than like Eastern Ohio, you know? So like, to a certain extent, you know, I think that like where I lived was a battleground state between OSU and MSU, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like, you mentioned the Ohio State. They insist on the.
That's right. You can tell I'm not a sports guy, but it was definitely battleground territory for sure. And like, I don't know, I always liked Michigan. That's the irony in this battle. I feel like I have to rep Ohio, but like, I like Michigan a lot.
I've never hated Ohio either. Like, I feel like that's the trendy thing for Michiganders to do is like just hate on Ohio. And I guess it's because of the sports rivalry, but I've been to like Northwest Ohio a lot. I've even been to like the islands in Lake Erie for like a trip once. Like Put In Bay it's an interesting spot, I'd say. So like Northern Ohio it's an interesting place to visit. There's even like a waterfall somewhere to visit that I've always wanted to check out, but I've never really been like south of the Ohio River when I visited Ohio. But I've never found a reason to uniquely malign Ohio. I think in my experience, Indiana just remains like the odd man out, so to speak.
Yeah. Indiana sucks.
But in your Sus Indiana episode, like there was it was almost a throwaway line, but it made things click for me where the early settlers of Indiana were from Virginia and the Carolinas, and suddenly everything clicked. Because I think the earliest settlers for Ohio and Michigan were from upstate New York.
Which I think explains potentially a lot about these two states, right? And then there were subsequent, at least in Ohio, I think also in Michigan, there were subsequent waves of hillbillies basically as well.
That's what I'm familiar with, although I'm very poorly read on that history. But I think on the Trillbillies, they were talking about some kind of line between Louisville to Detroit through 75. So
yeah, Eastern Ohio is basically Kentucky in terms of culture. And that whole thing with J.D. Vance and everything where it's
right.
Yeah, it's funny.
Fuck that guy.
Yep.
And then, to that point as well, Midwest identity is kind of this meme thing that people talk about, but how would you define it? Is Midwest nice a real thing? Do you think it makes people less likely to identify problems or et cetera?
I think it is a real thing, and not in that way where in Minnesota they're actually just being passive aggressive. I think that in Ohio and Michigan, people genuinely are nice. For my money, if for some reason this were a bet, I would put money on most of the lack of awareness of all the sus ass shit in these two states, or I guess just Michigan. I chalk that up mostly to just shitty education and just that hegemonic ideological thing bearing down on all of us. I think we're going to go through a bunch of stuff, and your Michigan listeners will probably know some of what we're going to be talking about, but they probably don't have a conceptual framework to put this in categories where you can be wait, why is Michigan so weird then? And it's because of this force and this force and this force and this force. So I think it's mostly just poor education rather than being too nice personally.
I think that's fair. I'm going to condense maybe a couple questions into this one. So with that knowledge kind of being out of sight, out of mind, the way we've kind of memory hold everything with ideological, blindsiding and poor education and really stifling what I could consider a sense of inquisition or curiosity. Do you think Michigan is uniquely situated to have its level of susness?
I've thought a lot about this, right? Because on paper, in terms of parapolitical topics, there are some heavy hitters out there in terms of states that are just never going to get knocked off their pedestal. We're talking the Florida, we're talking Texas, we're talking California, New York, Virginia, maybe places where it's either major borders and just all kinds of different weird sus organized crime and spy groupings and military and shit. And then when you get into the Midwest, because everything is so deathly boring sometimes, that's where I think it can be really interesting to examine when a state is quote unquote sus. And I've tried to unpack on my show what does it actually mean to be sus or suspect? And for my money, it's do weird things happen that just take everyone off guards? A bunch. Are there a bunch of weird anomalous things that if you really dig end up being connected, but on the surface you wouldn't think that there's anything there? That's kind of my metric for at least the Midwestern sus framework.
What's the Bolaño quote from 2666? The amount of coincidences and how much misfortune they cause, something like that.
That's right. It was something like the amount of suffering, the less the coincidence, I think.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so at least with Florida or something like California, you kind of know what the inputs are to understand why the outputs are weird. But like with Michigan, it's kind of obfuscated. You're just like, you know, that's just a nice state. What's, and then it's like, oh, what the fuck? Like, it's just like crazy shit just pops off in Michigan. And like, you know, why is it that Michigan created one of the most prolific terrorist organizations in the history of the country?
Right.
Like what? Like, why? I'm talking the weathermen in this case, but like, you know, in terms of like
Michigan militia guy.
I know.
Two for two.
In terms of like bombings, the weathermen did like thousands of bombs. Like, they're like the Babe Ruth of like freaking domestic terrorism. Although they didn't, you know, tried not to kill a bunch of people. But anyway, I digress. Like, the point is, like, Michigan doesn't seem suspect, and like, you don't see the weird shit going in, so that when you see weird stuff coming out, it just, it surprises you. That's what I think. In some ways, yeah, I think it is uniquely suited to be more sus than other states.
Yeah, I was just going to follow that up with, like, there's this geopolitical concept called the Great Lakes Megalopolis, if you've ever heard of this.
No, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, so it's like, if you basically take all the major cities and like the surrounding locales of the Great Lakes, so you know, basically take like Michigan, Ontario, upstate New York, Ohio, that part of Indiana, like leading into Illinois, and then like Wisconsin, you have this like understated major population center that's also like an incredibly diverse area, not only in terms of like its populations, but also like its economy, its geographic position. Like, it's a very unusual geological formation compared to the rest of the United States. Like, to be surrounded by this much fresh water from what's basically like an accident from glaciers, right? You don't really have formations like this in the rest of the world.
Like, if you think about it, right, I think some of that is just purely economic-based reasons, because, like, shipping things by water is so freaking cheap, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, so much of, like, that whole megapolis thing you're describing is, like, due to the fact that, like, this part of the country was, like, the economic powerhouse, sort of, like, the Eastern Seaboard, which was, you know, basically the larger version of the same thing because it's the ocean. Like, interesting.
Yeah, and it's like, in addition to just like the material reality created by like easy shipping routes, it also just opens it up to like colonialism in the early days in very unique ways. Mm-hmm. It's also like easily available drinking water. You've got like nice fish stores. It has a mediating effect on the climate. So, you know, Michigan is kind of, there's this meme about it, like always being like somewhat crazy with the weather, where like it'll be hot, then raining, and then snowing all in the same week. But it kind of moderates what would be otherwise like major heat or like major snow events as a result. It's just a very unique position in terms of like geopolitics, ecology, all of that. And it positions it also, in addition to just being like a land and water border to Canada. It's a very unusual but also understated formation in the United States that I don't think exists anywhere else in the world.
And I don't think people, like the average person, thinks that much about like exactly how much shipping and industry goes through these lakes. Like, you know, it is huge.
Yeah. So, to say the least, yeah, it's probably like one of the most beautiful regions in the United States as a result, but it is uniquely positioned as, like, maybe by fate and by, in this case, not just structure, but the people who maintain those structures, to be this weird bed of activity.
Yeah, and I think that it doesn't have that reputation. But as we're going to see, it should, because it is definitely a hotbed for this type of stuff.
Yeah. So, for this discussion, I'm going to be drawing pretty heavily from Dark Side of the Mitten, as I mentioned. It's a good book if you can get your hands on it. It's not very expensive. I just doubt it's very widely circulated.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Carr starts that... The book itself is actually very funny because Carr himself is... He makes a point to mention this in the book where his grandfather or some relative of his was a Michigan Supreme Court justice. And he decides to look into his record and look into some of his early cases. And then he finds that his relative was a judge who basically ordered this family in Lansing to, this black family in Lansing to vacate their home. As it turns out, that family was Malcolm X's family. Literally, his mother and his father were basically evicted on this judge's orders. And then it's very poetic for the author to like realize this and then very humbly just admit, yeah, that's fucked up what happened. I'm not going to lie about it, and I'm not going to make any excuses for this relative of mine.
Holy shit. Let me ask you, actually, because like Malcolm X's family, right? I did have a note, like they lived in Michigan, or not, yeah, Michigan. And like separately, their house got burned down. Is it, so do you know if this was a different house or like a...
Oh, the story as it goes, God, my partner is reading the autobiography of Malcolm X right now too, so this is very timely, but basically like his family was, I think, from the Dakotas. They lived in the Dakotas and
yeah,
they were basically chased out of the Dakotas by the Klan. So that's where that first house being burned down, that incident happens. I think they eventually make their way over to Michigan. This home that they get evicted from, I think, is not their first home in Michigan. It's the second one they try to... Or I think it is the first home they move to. And I think, again, like, a mob tries to burn this home down again. And that's, like, one of his formative memories.
Okay, I see. Okay, because I was conflating stories for sure, because, yeah... I think you're right. The Klan burned down the house over in like Nebraska, I think.
Nebraska, and then, yes.
And then separately, when they were in Michigan, their family was harassed by the Black Legion.
Yes, the Black Legion. About. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. He mentions them by name in the book, actually, which is surprising.
Yeah, and like when I read Malcolm X's autobiography, that just went right over my head. Like, as we'll see, the Black Legion was specifically a very interesting, weird group.
Yeah, we're gonna get into that one. So let's probably start from the beginning. So we can't start any story about injustices in America without first admitting, you know, you want to cancel me for doing a land acknowledgement? Let's go.
Listen, I think that like, it can be hokey to like do it, you know, at like your Goldman Sachs investors meeting, but like, I don't think that like talking about the original sins of the country is absolutely like a bad thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Not to be Mr. Too Damn Woke here, but I think you cannot really talk about these events without addressing that. So to start, we would be remiss not to mention that Michigan exists. First, as a former French holding that was expropriated from, among others, peoples of the Iroquois Confederacy, the Huron, Wyandot, Miami, and Odawa. And we cannot state the mismanagement and plundering by types like Antoine de la Motte, Sieur de Cadillac. I think that's how you say it in French. So that is the same guy who the luxury car brand is named after.
I did not know that. I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, so Cadillac is where he's from in France, and Antoine de la Motte, I think that's his full name. So Sieur de Cadillac is a noble title he invented for himself. He is not a noble by birth.
Let's be real, all of them are fake, but some are more fake than others.
I mean, you're not wrong, because what is the nobility but like a a thing you make up for yourself? But in this case specifically, he's not born into the nobility. He's this enterprising crook who sees the colonial expeditions as a way to like seek upward mobility. So he invents this title, Sieur de Cadillac. Sieur, in this case, I think translates directly to sire. He has a noble house sigil created. You can see that as the Cadillac logo now, believe it or not.
It's almost like the original sin of the state is like one of its foremost symbols or something.
I mean, I'm just going to say something very inflammatory, which is like automobiles are inherently fascist. We can get into that as Hells a whole.
Yeah. But agree. So,
but specifically in the case of Cadillac vehicles, right? General Motors it's a subsidiary of General Motors, for those of you who are not familiar with the breeds of car. And basically GM is notorious for this business practice called badge engineering. Every car company does this. Different competing companies will badge engineer each other's cars to sell them in different markets. If you didn't know this, you're going to learn this now, where basically most GM vehicles are pretty much the same machine with different exteriors. So your luxury Cadillac is basically the same parts as a Chevy, but with like, you know, a more shiny hull and like leather seats, basically. So just in general, right? Like this luxury car brand is already a kind of Potemkin thing that should be addressed. And Antoine de la Motte, in this case, you know, he's making his way across the French territory. We don't know a lot about how he got to the Americas. We don't know a lot about his latter days in France. So to fill in the picture, he is this privateer that just translates to pirate. This guy was a pirate scalping, you know, British shipments coming into the colonies. And when
so it's not all bad. Just kidding.
maybe there's, you know, there's always a silver lining to certain activities like this. But one thing we can definitely say he did that was bad is, you know, he used alcohol to weasel his way into securing the fur trade, as well as creating the conditions for the lumber industry as a whole to become a dominant form of the state's economy prior to the automotive industry. And specifically, I don't know if he invented the practice. This is one of those like recurring narratives in early colonial history of like European settlers getting indigenous people drunk and taking advantage of their lands. But you could argue Cadillac basically invented this practice, the way he was applying it.
Yeah, because I know that there are antecedents. One thing I've learned through history, right, is that anything that they were doing in the Americas, chances are the Portuguese were doing it in Africa.
Probably, yeah.
But that doesn't mean that he probably wasn't innovating it specifically in this context.
Yeah, it's more so that he was heavily reliant on this strategy, because another thing that gets brought up in Carr's book is that liquor was also your tool to control your men on these expeditions, and he basically understood that the cost of these furs would fetch such a bounty, it was not worth keeping his men happy with the hooch, so to speak, and getting it all to the indigenous people to steal furs, basically. So the settlement of the Straits, Detroit, is basically where we get the word Detroit as a result, is part of this colonial history, and it can't be stressed enough that Cadillac had weaseled his way into the governorship of the Louisiana Territory, establishing a lead mine in Missouri that was also an early importer of African slaves. While he did allegedly serve a sentence in the Bastille, it's unknown why. People hypothesize It has to do with him insulting the king. he was given honors later by the French government and retired in the countryside. A grand injustice of history, knowing that this period, if not began, was like one of the early chapters in the ecological destruction and human immiseration that began in the Americas as a result of this colonial project.
The French Revolution did not go far enough.
You know, what's that old Mao quote where it's like, you know, I don't really think the French Revolution really ended?
Oh, yeah. Wasn't it like Zhu Enlai or whatever? He was like, it's too soon to tell if, like, was that it? Or
I don't know. It could have been Zhou Enlai. I don't remember if... I remember it being attributed to Mao. Maybe a different
quote, honestly. I might
maybe they both said it. Maybe they both said it. I don't know. But yeah. I recall it being attributed to Mao, recalling that the source was the History Channel. Who knows how correct that was.
Yeah.
And then specifically, let's maybe get to Michigan as a hub of human trafficking. We're not really in a particular order with this. We're going to try to see where everything intersects. But, you know, my listeners, if they're not familiar now, should be familiar that we go all over the place. We jump. I'm happy to jump. So yeah, I'm gonna cut that in, but but yeah, it's like you know, as you mentioned with parapolitics, it's about drawing connections with things that seem disparate.
Mm-hmm.
And as we get closer, you know, further into the episode, you'll see how all this connects. So getting into Michigan as a hub of human trafficking, Michigan has been understood in recent years to be a hub of human trafficking. And it's this, you know, it's this hot button topic as of late in a lot of like suburban, like, you know, crime fears. It's one of the things that people cite. But specifically, my understanding of human trafficking at this point is that there's two main forms that people should pay attention to, which is human trafficking for sexual exploitation and human trafficking for specifically labor exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's likely for its proximity to the Canadian border and global shipping. But I guess in the modern context, what do you know about this?
So one thing I think I would want to emphasize to the listener is that, like, people probably, maybe they've gone to the airport, and often you'll see those signs like, if you see someone being human trafficked, right, use the hotline, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, what I want to emphasize to people is that human trafficking happens where commercial traffic happens, just general, any type of traffic. We're talking like anywhere, like a lot of goods are being exchanged, like, you know, major cities, obviously that's a hub, but also like truck stops, also just like around, you know, airports, you know,
shopping malls as well.
Exactly. And like historically, I actually did an episode on this that'll come out eventually, Lord knows when, but like department stores, traffic in the commercial sense. Historically, large department stores used to be a hub for sex traffic.
Mm.
It's not so much anymore. Probably it's changed maybe, but like, I guess maybe now you could say it's digitally, like, you know, you go to like Craigslist or Backpages or something, but like historically it was like where the shopping is, where the travel is, like traffic. That's where people are being human trafficked. That's pretty much what I would say.
Mm-hmm. So in Thomas Carr's book, he does bring up that while it is like this modern topic that gets a lot of attention, it's not necessarily a modern issue. And in fact, in the past, there was an aggressive trend of human trafficking for the sex trade that occurred in the northern part of the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, and I think parts of northern Wisconsin at the time. And what was fueling this back in the day was the proliferation of the lumber trade and mining in the northern parts of Michigan specifically. I'm sure it was probably similar conditions in Wisconsin. So as journalism and like newspapers start to get more sophisticated is when coverage of these events starts to not only earn some public interest, but also is more heavily reported on. Not necessarily with the same care that I think people have nowadays, but it was definitely like a public interest topic at the time. And stories of women being enticed with work or compelled to make the trek to the northern part of the state, only to then find themselves trapped in areas where the predominant form of work was mining or lumber, were basically being either coerced or pressured into prostitution at that point.
Yeah, and like what I want to also emphasize, right? Like people nowadays, if they think of like labor human trafficking, they'll think maybe like different Latin American groups, but like they basically did that in the mines with mostly like a lot of like European groups. So it'd be like, let's get the Finns in here to work in these mines. Oh, that's kind of played out. Let's get some like Croats to come over here. Let's get like the Swedes, you know, like there were different waves of these like clusters of immigrant groups that would like basically a lot of times be tricked into working these horrible like mining jobs. And definitely like women were getting trafficked in relation to that. Yeah, exactly. Like, have you seen Deadwood, the TV show?
I'm familiar with it. I still got to check it out, but I'm familiar with what the show's about.
It's good and bad. But like, basically it depicts similar things going on where there's like miners and prospectors sometimes getting tricked in, similar things with the women. And then like the innkeeper, he's almost like an evil Mr. Krabs, where he's like trying to get people to spend their wages on liquor and, you know, sex work. And like a lot of company towns were like that. They would pay bad wages and then they would get you to waste your paycheck on like the vices that they also controlled.
And then, it puts you in that position where like you're already pissed off about your conditions, but you're kept pliable and compliant with these vices pretty much. And on top of that, your already meager wages are then stripped.
Yep.
And then, to our victims of the sex trafficking in this case, a lot of this was done by either pimps or madams in this case, who would basically take the proceeds for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So to try to maybe wrap like this particular thread up, there were two independent investigations launched by the state of Michigan and the state of Wisconsin at the time. The investigation for Michigan turns up suspiciously that this is not happening.
Around what year is this, ballpark?
I don't have the book in front of me. You mind if I go grab it? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I like learning. So I was like, oh, when was that?
Yeah. Let me go grab the book just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't lying. I found it. All right. So when are these investigations launched? The summer of 1888.
Interesting. That pretty much is like Deadwood era. I think. Interesting.
Yeah, so I would say that like probably in the latter part of that chapter where Carr refers to this, basically this becomes one of the organizing issues that the temperance movement gets behind. because of the links between, you know, sex trafficking, prostitution, and liquor at this time. So it becomes this kind of cause célèbre of that movement.
That makes sense. Because, like, it's funny, right? Because, like, for various, mostly stupid reasons, mainly being raised Mormon, I was, like, almost, like, weirdly, like, pro-prohibition growing up. Which is, like, by the way, not a normal Mormon position to have. Like, I was just a weird kid. But, like, I definitely, like, spent a lot of time, like, reading about prohibition as a kid because I was a weirdo. And, like, that's the thing about, like, the suffrage and, like, you know, prohibition movement is that they had, like, a lot of, like, really good grounded reasons for opposing, like, the liquor trade. It's just that, like, you know, for a lot of other very grounded reasons, it's, like, not a workable policy, but...
Yeah, I mean, to your earlier dispute with the other podcast, right, you know, the temperance movement wasn't saying that alcohol is a structural issue. I think they understood very clearly that there is this kind of economic force linking the formation of patriarchy to the economic incentives behind selling liquor, but I'd say that they just didn't have the effective language to describe that link that later, you know, labor feminists and Marxist feminists would later describe. I think just, I don't, again, like, not to shill for Marx here, but no, I will. Is that, oh, yeah. You know, exactly, like Marxist thought and, you know, materialist frameworks actually give you the base to link these disparate issues.
Yeah, that's well said. And, like, it's interesting, right? Because, like, the liquor companies are fucking evil. Like, they are. Like post-prohibition, they were all mobbed up. Like, a lot of different actual criminal organizations basically just became the, like, liquor industry. And, like, they, like, a lot of them, quote unquote, went legit, sure, but, like, guess what? Then you end up with John McCain. Like, to make that more clear, like, John McCain's, I think, was it his wife was, like, from, like, a liquor fortune, and they basically bankrolled his political career. So, like, shit's mobbed up. That's basically the TLDR of that. But, like, I did want to actually shout out my buddy Boyd Beaver, who lives in a unspecified small town in Michigan, and he damn near lost his mind when he found out that there were bootlegging tunnels in his town that were dug by the Meyer Lansky Syndicate, and that one of the tunnels connects to the local Catholic church. And he was just like, what the fuck? Like, this stuff has always been weird, and there's always been, like, reason to think there's more going on than what we can just see, you know?
Yeah, to say the least. And on that similar vein, right, you know, the the links between, you know, organized crime and enabling certain further criminal acts, like, you know, human trafficking in this case, continue into the modern day. So this is probably, we're just going to start with probably maybe one of the tough ones early on. North Fox Island. This is either a sticking point, if you're in the listener base for a program to chill, you might be familiar with this if you're from Michigan. But to be very honest, it's kind of been one of those events that's been memory hold, that I think is worth maybe revisiting in this context. So maybe, do you want to get into the broad strokes of that?
Yeah, for sure. I'll go through it, and, like, for the listener's sake, you know, we're not going to probably get into the really hairy details of it, but for sure, like, heads up, you know, like, it's not fun stuff. So, like, the basics, right, is that North Fox Island is one of many islands that are, like, part of Michigan. But, like, you know, I think, like, you, like, what's the deal? Like, you can buy them, right? Like, it's a lot of these are private property. Some are, like, owned by the state or whatever. But, like...
So, I'm not sure what the current position is on the legality of buying an island, right? But it's not the first time that these islands have been settled or even been used to some nefarious end. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Mackinac Island is one of these initial places where, again, for the control of the early fur trade, colonial control, and just like for military administration, they set up a fort on that island. I think another time, too, there's like some weird cult in like the 1800s that sets up on one of these islands.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has like an assassination plot. Once again, another let's make ourselves the governor of Michigan plot in these islands. That's another crazy one, but it's, I think that one is pretty shut and dry. But North Fox Island is a couple miles or so away from North and South Bear Island, I think. So a couple miles away from the Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lake Shore. And at the time, I think this was privately owned by somebody. We can get into that.
That's right. Now, I think the main player here is a guy named Francis Sheldon, who was a millionaire. And at the time that we're talking about, he did own the island. And he operated a thing called Brother Paul's Children's Mission there.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was a child pornography ring. And part of the ring, I guess, part of the operation was that they had a private airport. Now, presumably, Sheldon probably had a number of these guys, but he, you know, one particular guy was found, and that's how they uncovered the whole thing. But basically, Sheldon had this, like, lackey, I guess, who was a gym teacher in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And he, this guy was basically, his name was Gerald Richards, and mm-hmm. taught, yeah, at St. Joe's in Port Huron. And he was several things. He was such a weird dude. He was a gym teacher. He was a masseuse. He was a magician. He worked at adult bookstores, and he groomed kids. Like, this is some, like, freaking weird shit. And, like, if your listeners aren't already thinking Epstein connections, there are so many, from the islands to the masseuse shit. Like, there's a lot here to compare between the two cases.
Yeah, and just to interject.
But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just to interject briefly, too. Like, Sheldon actually bought the island in the 60s, in 1960, for $20,000. Which is the equivalent to about $175,000 today.
Which is relatively cheap in terms of, like, what he ends up doing. Although I guess, like, there's, like, a lot of, like, clout and political backing you probably also need to get away with this type of shit for as long as he did.
Mm-hmm.
So, basically, in 1976, this Gerald Richards guy gets basically accused by some underage victims of abuse. And so the parents get involved and the police end up arresting Richards. Richards basically, like, implicates Francis Sheldon, but the authorities don't arrest Sheldon right away, even though he was, like, extremely guilty. Basically, the authorities, like, slow walk arresting Sheldon, which allowed Sheldon to basically flee to France, where there is no extradition treaty.
I think it was the Netherlands, but it could have been France. Well,
he ends up in Amsterdam.
Okay.
Right. So initially France, but then he resettles in Amsterdam, where there is an active, less, like, it's known that there's a pedophile scene in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that is the, in broad strokes, basically they had an island where a millionaire was producing child pornography. That's That's the gist of it. And there's all kinds of like weird details on top of that, but
yeah, I mean, it's definitely like tough stuff to get into, but it's one of those things that is worth investigating, because if you're like me and you're like, well, okay, Michigan's this quiet, beautiful place, but what's lurking under the quiet? This is one of those memory hold stories that I think is worth investigating. And if anyone's familiar with the podcast, The Clown and the Candyman, they have like a, I think a 20-minute or so episode on this, and they interview one of the victims directly, and he gets to speak in very plain detail about what happened. So I would rather, you know, people follow up with that resource to read about this further. But this is probably the point where now we're just going to start jumping places. We can't really talk about North Fox Island without talking about what some people believe to be linked to this event, which is the incident of the Oakland County child killing. So do you want to get into the broad strokes of that one as well?
Yeah, for sure. So,
and this is also one of those ones that's like really memory hold. Like, I think people remember it if they were like from the 80s or 90s, so to speak. But then like most people I've talked to, that's like one of those things that's been memory hold too.
Yeah, like, it's interesting. Like, I had family in the general area, and like, most of them didn't even remember that there were Oakland County child killings in the first place, which I don't blame them for not wanting to remember, but, you know. So, basically, the short version is that, like, 1976, 1977, around when, you know, this North Fox Island stuff was shaking up, four children were abducted in the Detroit suburbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And were held for days before their bodies were found. Typically, like, in the snow, on, like, near roads. And basically, in all likelihood, the Oakland County child killer was this guy named Christopher Bush.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge amount of evidence as to like why he was at least one of the killers. And I would recommend the book The Snow Killings if you'd like to know more about that. And Adi, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't there also a pretty good podcast on it?
The Clown of the Candyman also covers this one. Like, I think either before or after they cover North Fox Island.
Gotcha. And I'm trying to remember if there was one specifically dedicated to the Oakland County killings, but either way, like, there's, like, this is stuff that, like, has been documented elsewhere, and I am not necessarily an expert on this case, like, by any means. So, what's important, I think, before I get into who Christopher Bush was, I think people need to think about criminal organizations, right?
Right.
And take, like, drug traffickers. Drug traffickers typically don't operate in a vacuum. They will often know other drug traffickers because they've maybe done deals with each other. Maybe they might, you know, have grudges with each other. But typically, drug traffickers know other drug traffickers. People, like, pedophiles, basically, they know other pedophiles. Like, these different networks of, like, child porn are linked. Like, it's not to say that it's an overarching conspiracy, but, like, it's like nexuses. Like, this cluster is over here, and then one or two of the guys might know this other group in this other place. Like, it's you know, not that different from other criminal organizations, is what I would say.
Yeah, and it's like, knowing every detail of these nexuses can get dicey, right? Because how much of this gets, you know, shown to the public, that's not always, you know, up for discussion. how much of this is stuff you want to look at to begin with. That's also, you know, I don't fault anyone for not wanting to read about this.
Mm-hmm.
But in the specific case of North Fox Island and the specific case of the Oakland County child killings, in both instances, a wider network of people perpetrating child abuse was uncovered in both cases. The extent to which I cannot speak, I'm willing to admit I'm squeamish to know how far it goes, but to know it goes anywhere at all is something that should concern everyone, right?
Precisely. And like, there was like strong evidence that Christopher Bush interacted in some way with the North Fox Island operation. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, Sheldon escaped to basically end up in Amsterdam because he's a millionaire. Now, what happens to Christopher Bush is also kind of telling due to his family. Okay.
Indeed.
So Bush actually attended a very interesting boarding school in Switzerland, Le Rossi. You did a good job with French. How would you say Le Rossi? I'm so bad.
I feel like you brought it up. I'm just reading this like Le Rossi. What the?
I know. I'm like Le Rossi. Une école pour la vie. Something like that. But like basically.
Le Rosé. Okay. There we go.
Hey, that sounded great. Okay. Le Rosé. So, like, we're talking, like, some serious fucking people send their kids to this boarding school. We're talking Cavendish, Rothschild, Metternich, Borghese, Rockefellers, DuPont, Gettys.
Mm-hmm.
Actual royalty. Like, the Shah sent his kids there. The royal family of Belgium. Aga Khan IV, like the Strokes. You remember that band? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Two of them went to this fucking school. Like, this is like a serious, like, school. And the reason why he went to that boarding school is because, let's see here. Crap, where'd it go? His dad was an executive.
Yep. Specifically for the European division of General Motors?
That's right. Executive financial director, in fact.
Now, this is where I could not find a lot that was conclusive. You know, it gets my Geiger counter really clicking when I think about the time period that he was the executive financial director in Europe for GM at the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can't help but think, was he at least marginally working with defense contracting during, like, the Marshall Plan? Who's to say?
Well, I mean, it was also, like, you said earlier, like, cars are fascist, which sounds crazy maybe to some people, but, like, dude, there are literally far-right... during the years of lead Gladio shit, there mm-hmm. are literally terrorist acts that were funded by Italian auto companies to undermine public transit. Like, this is not crazy. This is like real world shit.
Jesus.
Anyway, so basically, Christopher Bush, extremely guilty of abducting, maybe killing several of these kids. There's like we said, there are books and podcasts that are proving the case. So this is just a high level thing. But like, one of the most horrific details of all is that Bush had a drawing, like he was like an artist, of one of the victims on the wall of his apartment. And the child is like screaming in the drawing. It's haunting. Like,
yeah,
you should like think about whether you want to see it before you know. Look at it. But like, so basically Bush, I think he got arrested more than once, right? And yeah, he kept getting let go, you know.
And he gets that are either questioned or arrested by police too. If not named, they mention him.
Mm-hmm.
And they interview one of the cops in the episode I'm referring to in Clown of the Candyman, so you can hear the officer's testimony in that episode as well.
So Bush, basically, he shoots himself with a .22 rifle between the eyes. And it's a long rifle, not a gun that you would typically probably pick for, like, killing yourself. I'm just guessing. He manages to do this without getting gunpowder on his hands while he's tucked into bed, you know, the way most people kill themselves. And the first officer on the scene was a guy named Richard McNamee, who would later be convicted of molesting kids. So, in all likelihood, this crooked cop probably killed this guy. Probably to keep him quiet about the broader network or something. Because, like, they will probably try to protect someone who has, like, a important dad to a certain point. But after a certain point, no one is, like, completely, you know, untouchable. And, like, especially if other people might get, implicated, they will kill you. So, like, that's probably what happened here.
Yeah, so specifically, I'm reading from Carr here. Christopher Bush was a convicted pedophile who copped a plea in another case. Mm-hmm. He was questioned in the Oakland County killings, failed a polygraph test, but was released. So not only is, you know, the level of police involvement possibly in his death somewhat suspicious, even the legal proceedings involved in all this too are somewhat suspect. So this may seem like a digression, but this is somewhat tangentially tied in here too to everything you just mentioned. So remember what we were saying about cars coming in to destroy public transit? Just keep that in your mind. Keep that in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to introduce very briefly to the narrative one L. Brooks Patterson. He's not a necessarily major figure, per se, but if you live in Oakland County, you might recall this guy. So just a brief overview of Oakland County, right, is that it's one county over from Detroit. I'd say the major players to understand in this area is Wayne County, which is pretty much the major industrial hub containing Detroit, and several other industrial areas. Oakland County, which is pretty much where all the money outside of the city goes, and where people commute back to, especially post Detroit riots. A lot of the white flight is concentrated in Oakland County. And then Macomb County, which is where the rest of people went after white flight. Some of it may have even gone further north, depending on who you ask. Macomb County, I basically call it Michigan's New Jersey. I wouldn't say conclusively that the Michigan mob would operate out of there, but I would say that those elements tied into migrating out of Detroit after the riots went that way. That's my assumption. So Patterson comes around as this guy who's a defender of post-riots segregation. There is a push in the city of Pontiac to integrate busing, have white kids and black kids go to school on the same buses. Patterson steps out bravely with other culture warriors of his time, says, "We're not doing this." The Klan heads out and burns buses. And he is able to spin some of this reactionary sentiment and these suburban fears into becoming the Oakland County prosecutor. Suspiciously, he's also the county prosecutor during this case. And the plea deal in this case is one that was given to Bush by Patterson. I could only find a couple limited articles about it. Not many details about how or why that plea deal was given. I couldn't find any, like, anyone else commenting on it, or, like, you know, so it's all very much open to interpretation how and why. But to say the least, after this, Patterson would later go on to become the county executive for Oakland County. So to stress this again, Oakland County contains at least, I think, one of the richest zip codes in the United States within it. I think that area is Bloomfield Hills, for anyone who's curious. Patterson, as county executive, nets a salary that's even higher than the state governor's somehow. And basically never had to answer any questions about it. I think the last time that it was brought up regarding this plea deal was 2012, which seems like years ago now.
And like, for the listeners, like, a lot of families were deeply upset at like these deals and like exactly how things played out. But like, yeah, they just didn't have to answer questions about it. No accountability, nothing.
Yeah, and specifically, you'll hear families of the victims, I think in the episode I'm citing here from Clown of the Candyman, they basically talk about this as like their harrowing introduction to the concept of stranger danger, right? At the same time, you have the auto industry coming in and tearing up some of these older ways that kept the city connected to the suburbs, namely the streetcars, right? So streetcars were easily accessible public transit at the time. The area that's now Woodward Road runs from the city of Pontiac to the center of Detroit. That used to be a streetcar line, and that was basically shut down. Basically, verbatim Judge Doom speech from Who Framed Roger Rabbit is how the freeways replace public transit and effectively choke off the city from the suburbs, further segregating it. And the automotive industry basically steps in and sells, you know, this new vision of consumer convenience to Americans in the form of this is what I mean when I say the automobile is fascist. It's a more individualized form of transit. It's you, maybe like what, four other people at most coming in your vehicle. You have to take
atomized.
It's atomized. There's more people like on the road in these individualized vehicles, so you take up more volume. And you know, to top it off, it's fueled by the petroeconomy, and we can get into how that itself is both fuel for and fueled by the American imperial structure. So again, like, this digression may seem, you know, somewhat haphazard, but this is once again to go to show that like there is weird shit going on in terms of very wealthy people shaping the economic forces in our society, also being able to get away with very strange and very unjust actions.
Yeah. And
you're only touching the tip of the iceberg.
Like, there is a even more horrifying conclusion that we talked about but just couldn't really prove. Like, there's hints that there's more going on, but we're, I think, very much sticking to what we can prove right now. But like, there's reason to think there's even more connections, and that the network possibly involves a lot more of the auto industry at the high executive level, actually.
Yeah, and that's, you know, let's just elaborate on that, right? Because, yeah, we can't find, quote-unquote, a smoking gun. Maybe it's not even our job, per se, to find that smoking gun, right? But I think this is a necessary exercise to go through, especially if you self-identify as being part of the left, right? Because you have to be able to name, one, the various actors involved in power and how it's used, what they're up to, and then specifically, this is the angle that I think is most important, is that being able to point at this much suspicion, at these many questions being left open, at this much information not being known or available to the public, in itself is a cause for concern. And I think it's actionable, even if you can't conclude anything from it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think so. Like, it sounds like we're basically, like, pointing to things that we can't prove. But the thing is, no less than Congress, in no small part involving this case, actually held hearings to change the laws relating to basically child pornography and child abuse. And they did that in 1977. So they had a subcommittee and they basically investigated Sheldon and this child porn ring. And basically this journalist here, not by any means like a fringe person, this journalist, J. Reuben Appleman, who wrote The Kill Jar, which was a book specifically looking at these incidents, he basically argues that Francis Sheldon of North Fox Island was serving as an executive of the child pornography industry, which was a nationwide and indeed international big business. And like, this isn't something that I'm saying. This is what the Senate is saying. You know, these were findings in this hearing on the hearings before the subcommittee to investigate juvenile delinquency. Like, I'm not making this up. This was Congress talking about it, you know?
Yeah, and I think, again, it's like, people might look at this and be like, well, this is depressing, or like, what's actionable from this? And I think it's like, it's what was probably stated early on, which is that, once again, the families of these victims deserve to know, to have answers, and deserve to have justice for this. You know, I don't want to get like very, you know, epic on the internet with this, but sexual impropriety and a lot of these crimes produce the victims who are unable to speak up, or don't know that they can speak up, or feel like they will be shut out of the world if they ever, you know, bring to light what happened to them. And it's like, not to be very hokey with it, but what kind of message are we sending to the world if we don't even show that we're willing to hear some of this out, or even just think that, like, you know, we'll do what little we can to make sure people are heard with some of this?
Absolutely. And like, I really, really like that you linked basically the destruction of public transit can be linked convincingly, maybe not a smoking gun link, but like, can be linked to this fucking crazy child abuse shit. It is the same people who will basically, not necessarily the same people doing it, but the same people will assist in a bureaucratic position to make both things happen, you know, two different, very different crimes. And so, like, when there's like a well-meaning but generally like maybe naive like DSA guy who's like, I think that it was a crime that there's not as much public transit, and it's like, yes, you're right, and the people that did it are fucking evil, and they exactly. also were involved in this crazy child abuse shit. Like, the two things are both like hand in hand. Actually, it's insane to think about.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I don't begrudge people for feeling squeamish about it, or maybe not wanting to speak on it as openly, right? Because, yeah, these are uncomfortable topics. But it's like, you know, I don't think it's naive to say things are linked. I don't think it's naive to say things flow from end to end, that there's there's a big picture way to look at things. And it's like, you know, if someone's name shows up in one case and then shows up in another thing that is suspicious but seems unknown and bringing back that Bolaño quote, right? The amount of coincidence with the amount of misfortune. You have good reason to begin, one, suspecting the legitimacy and the authority of the people who lead our systems. Okay. And mm-hmm. then you have, furthermore, again, to maybe bring up this beef you had with the other show, right? It's like, so if the structure itself is the problem, why then can't we talk about the people who staff it? And then fundamentally, then the structure itself is irredeemable. What do you do in that case? Other than admit that this thing is like rotten from the bottom to the top.
Yeah. It's like either we need to reform it or we need to just change it. Like, which is it going to be? Because not talking about it. Well, I mean, that it has been the default. Like, but thankfully, you know, we can talk about it. And like, you know, I'm not grandiose enough to think that like things I say are going to like end up mattering that much. But like, I'm not going to be like, you're not going to piss on my leg and tell me it's raining, at least. Like,
exactly.
You know?
I mean, I'm fully willing to admit I could be wrong. I'm fully willing to admit that everything I've said up to this point could be wrong. What I'm really speaking to is, like, the principle of this, which is that if it sounds crazy, why? Why does it keep sounding crazy? Why do the same people keep showing up in these crazy stories?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we mean by sus. And I think that's really like why people are reticent to understand some of this or accept some of this, because it's like, but wait, I thought we could trust those in authority. I thought people who make it to positions of power make it through because we have a meritocracy or whatever. And it's like, I think these incidents trigger these moments of apostasy in our civic religion that are jarring for people. And it's hard to digest. I'm not going to say it isn't hard to digest.
Exactly. But like, if you look at the way things are going, and I'm assuming like your listeners don't like where society is going.
Right.
Like, more likely than not, there's a major issue with the leadership, and there's a major issue with the ideology that we currently have. There's a major issue with the parties, with the structural, like with the institutions, and like we just have to be able to talk frankly about all these things.
Spot on. And like, as you're going to see, this particular period of time is where a lot of these events happen, and you'll find that, huh, a lot of this sounds familiar, or like, that sounds a lot like what's going on now. Why did this really happen before? And that's basically, I'm trying to figure out where's our best natural jump, because these two are also tied. One, you mentioned our DSA guy and naive assumptions about transit, but then also that makes me think, do we talk about the origins of the DSA, so to speak, or do we talk about the auto industry as a whole?
Well, maybe it would make sense to talk about like the Detroit riots, perhaps. Because they were almost like the instigating factor for like the, you know, the white flight, and like that also overlaps with some of the radical stuff. I mean, honestly, any direction, we're going to walk into more stuff to talk about. So whatever, it's whatever you want.
Yeah. I think everything we're going to talk about is kind of linked, right? Mm. So maybe let's talk about the larger economic framework first, right? So we've talked about furs, we've talked about lumber, we've talked about those early forms of industry here in Michigan, but I think this is probably well known that the auto industry is a central industry. If you're part of any other industry today, like finance, IT, insurance, whatever, you're basically supporting people who work for the auto industry or supporting it as a supplier or external service, basically. So the auto industry is this major pillar of both the American consumer economy as a whole and its major profile of industries, so to speak. And it's not necessarily, you know, me being dramatic here to talk about the auto industry as in something fascistic, right? I think from the jump, there have been certain bizarre statements and occurrences by executives involved within it, namely Henry Ford. Some people are familiar with his anti-Semitism at a surface level. But
for your listeners who aren't familiar with my show, Henry Ford literally funded Adolf Hitler.
This is not a joke. Like, literally was, and Thomas Carr says this as much too, where like,
yeah.
He had pamphlets extolling the virtues of anti-Semitism and I think like supporting the Nazis in Ford dealerships. He had like a signed like certificate from Hitler that he hung up in his office, as well as like some awards and stuff. So the Hitler connection to Henry Ford is not like this tangential coincidence of like, oh, well, Henry Ford is this American titan of business who had some bad ideas. No, this is like where, to quote Zizek once again, it's pure ideology. I'm serious.
Like, to tell the very short version for your listeners,
yeah.
Adolf Hitler was a police snitch. He maybe was hypnotized, but that's another story. But at a certain point, the Nazi Party was funded and created basically by like German naval intelligence and like weird occultists, sure. But at a certain point, the Nazi Party really just wasn't making headway. And the thing that kept the Nazi Party afloat was Henry Ford's money. Later, he secured German heavy industry, and like, you know, they're off to the races. The rest is history. But like, literally, if Henry Ford didn't do that, we would not have had probably the Holocaust. I'm not being hyperbolic.
And this also goes to show, like, there is this bizarre, like, one ideological cross-pollination between like American settler colonial escapades, mm-hmm. so to speak, in our history, and Hitler basically like looking like, have you seen that meme of like America doing their homework in the class and Hitler like mm-hmm. copying off of it, and then America behind Germany copying it again?
Yeah,
and basically, I mean, everyone says they know how paperclip went, but that's like the shortest summary of it. But yeah,
well, and paperclip goes so much further than people think. That's another exactly. story. But like, it was so much more than just fucking NASA scientists anyway.
Yeah. So in addition to Henry Ford, let's talk about the business plot at the Mackinac Conference.
Excellent. Now, for the listeners out there, you might be thinking, business plot, what, the coup to replace FDR? Smedley Butler broke it up, the whole war is a racket guy. No, this is a different business plot, okay? So, listeners of my show would be familiar with this, probably, like, in broad strokes, but basically, not everyone was on board with World War II. Mm-hmm. Specifically, there were isolationist elements, whether that was informed by, like, being German-American or just being like a manufacturing and heavy industry, and like you're like a factory owner and you don't want to like switch over to wartime production or something, or you're just like, there were like major like isolationist elements in the Republican Party. Some of them were actually fascist, but some weren't, to be fair. And so like basically there was this big meeting on Mackinac Island to basically get all of the leaders of the Republican Party on board with World War II. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I have this quote here from Quigley, who is a very interesting scholar. And it goes, "Just at this time, considerable effort was being made in the United States to obtain popular commitments against any post-war return to isolationism. On September 7th, 1943, a conference of leaders of the Republican Party at Mackinac Island, Michigan, endorsed the hopes for a post-war international organization. 2 weeks later, the Fulbright resolution favoring such an organization passed the House of Representatives by a vote of 360-29, and in November, a similar expression, the Connolly resolution, was accepted in the United States by a vote of 85-5. Now, I probably just set that up wrong myself, but that was not to enter World War II. That was actually to continue, and that was basically to have the U.S. be the hegemonic dominator of, like, the world, like, after World War II. Basically, to continue to stay in, like, Germany, Japan, to have all of the military bases all over the world, as we're so used to now, that was not a foregone conclusion. And the Republican Party on Mackinac Island got into a big smoke-filled room and conspired to basically dominate the world. Like, I'm not making this stuff up. Yeah. Because I recently did some episodes on the more well-known business plot, and like, I was like, holy shit, was it planned at Mackinac? No, it wasn't.
Now I'm just like, did they name it the business plot to fuck with me? Like,
honestly, I don't know. Maybe I might have just called it that. I don't know if that's actually what, like, Quigley calls it. Quigley, yeah. By the way, who taught Bill Clinton. It's like Bill Clinton read Quigley's works and was basically like, ah, yes, the Anglo-American establishment. I'm going to join it. When conspiracy theory goes wrong, folks.
Oh, Mackinac Island itself, you know, you got to get there by ferry. The Mackinac Hotel specifically, it's a very exclusive club.
Mm-hmm.
If not for this conference, there's literally like several like gatherings like through the year where like titans of business and politics will like gather at the hotel, and it's, you know, you can't get in. I mean, it's to the point where like even if you're just like a regular Joe guest, you can't really get in without like a jacket. So very, very exclusive club there. You know, they were really trying to keep the riffraff out with that one.
Have you been to Mackinac Island?
Okay, so I'm going to get killed if I don't correct you and say it's Mackinac Island.
Listen, I went there once. I was like 12, so I clearly like forgot half of my local pronunciations.
You're good. I went there once, and I was there with a couple friends. We were just chilling. It was a nice summer day, and we kind of walked the entire length of the island. And there's like these like hills that are like there's trails in them. There's like a cave and shit, and like a lot of forested stuff. For me personally, I'm like a really innocent guy. I'm just looking at all the different birds. I didn't have the wherewithal at the time.
Yeah.
To you know, put like some of the stuff together. But we also like saw like what's preserved of the fort, the different like landing sites that are like hit up with markers and stuff. It's a cool little place. I like that you can't drive a car there. It's the one place where the auto industry has not touched.
Kind of ironic, actually.
Well, here's the thing. One time Mike Pence visited during the Trump years and literally, like, I think showed up with the vice presidential motorcade on the island. So he was, like, the first official in several years to violate that ordinance.
Flexing.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I went there, I think I was actually like 14. I had just discovered, for some reason, this is very clear in my mind, the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, God.
And so I was just like listening to that, and I was just like, yeah, I'm like a teenager now. And it was just like, it's so funny. Like, when I lived in this general region, I did not know any of this shit at all.
It's memory hold. I don't know if that's by design or if that's just like our nature as Midwesterners not to seek out unpleasant truths.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people just never learn it. Yeah, and then, like, you don't want to think about horrible things, too.
Yeah. But, you know, to that end, this is not the only intersection between conservative politics and the auto industry to kind of to force, one, you know, fascist activity, but also involvement in the war. You also mentioned to me that there's some interesting ties between the Klan, the Black Legion, and I think we already touched on Henry Ford's Nazi ties. So maybe how do the Klan and Black Legion tie into this?
Yeah, so the Black Legion in particular was one that I've really been fixated on lately. They were a fascist group that was explicitly based out of General Motors factories and plants. Okay. Now, this book, let's see here. Listeners, if you really want to know where I'll skip that. Okay. So basically, I have this passage here, and it says, "Today, one cannot understand the Detroit area without looking at the influence of fascism in the area. The riot," talking about the Detroit riots, "was provoked by the Klan, which was closely associated with fascism and the Bund at the time." For the listeners out there, that's like the German-American sort of organization. "However, there were many other fascist organizations active at the time within the Detroit area. The Black Legion, the Wolverine Republican League, Father Coughlin, and several other fundamentalist ministers of hate," you know, the book says, will be shown later in this chapter. "Michigan was one of the hot spots for fascism, as several of the strongest supporters of fascism within the halls of Congress came from Michigan."
Specifically, I think you mentioned here, 7 senators, 13 representatives had bribery and collusion with Nazi Germany, like half were of them were from Michigan.
That's right. Yeah. Just like a ridiculous amount.
Yeah.
And that's of the ones that were prosecuted, you know, during World War II. Presumably there could have been, you know, more, but they always pull their punches a little bit when they're prosecuting like actual Congress people.
Yeah. And even then, it's like, it's not just members of Congress too. Even like, once again, executives in the auto industry come up once again. I think you mentioned here.
Alfred P. Sloan, General Motors president, worked very closely with Nazi Germany. But I think probably the biggest kicker here, okay, here's a quote. And all of these, I think some of these quotes are coming from the book Nazi Nexus. I think some of them are coming from a lovely titled book called The Nazi Hydra in America. But here's a passage which says, "After World War II broke out, Ford Motor Company in Detroit helped the Nazis by ordering parts made in Ford's Cologne plant for use in Ford's factories in Latin America and Japan. Even after the U.S. entered the war, and the Reich by necessity placed American companies in receivership as enemy property, the Ford-Nazi relationship was one of global cooperation. Awaiting the outcome of the hostilities when Detroit would be able to collect on massive wartime profits. During the war years, Ford's pre-war management was kept in place. Only the profits were temporarily frozen in secure accounts." And here's the real kicker, okay? Ultimately, about a third of the Reich's trucks were manufactured by Ford. A 1945 U.S. Army report called Ford the arsenal of Nazism, with the consent of the company in Dearborn. I think I read somewhere that the company that made, like, the Tiger tanks that the Nazis used was, like, literally, like, a company collectively owned by like Ford and GM. It's just like absolutely insane. So like when someone like Thomas Pynchon, the author, says like the war isn't real, obviously it doesn't mean like that people weren't dying, but like on an international business level, they just fucking did whatever they wanted. They just worked with the Nazis. Just ridiculous.
It's always like a popular trope in like all forms of media where like anytime there's a war profiteering and weapons manufacturers are like, well, this is a great time for business right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, you know, like a ill-founded media trope for nothing. Like there's real historical precedent for this.
Yeah. So it's like Henry Ford funded Hitler. they worked with the Nazis through the war, and then, like, before, during, and after, they funded far-right U.S. politics. It's just like, so when you say cars are fascist, in context of history, yes, they literally are fascist. Like, I'm not, you know, saying that there isn't theoretically, like, a people's car out there, like the Lada or something, that isn't, like, it's not like it's, like, philosophically, like, metaphysically, inherently fascist, but, like, these companies are. The people conspiring are the fascists, right?
Yeah, and it's, like, this isn't to, like, malign people, especially who work at the plants who are just trying to, like, make a living, right? Like, this is really not directed at any of them at all, but this is to say, like, the real movers and shakers who pull all the levers of the economy and kind of, again, we, you know, as laborers, we sell our work. We don't really have much of a say. The unions that we have at this point still deserve to exist, still, should be strengthened. But at this point are more about bargaining for, like, what little protections we can have instead of really calling the shots on what's necessary or what needs to be produced, or more so, like, how much of this is really fucking necessary.
Exactly. There, I found it. Okay. Opel, the company that made tanks, owned a wholly owned subsidiary of General Motors and Ford. Fucking Opel, man. Like, they made the fucking Nazi tanks, man.
Like, right. And they're, like, the biggest subsidiary in Europe, I think, for GM.
Yeah. Just wild. It's wild. And they fully collected all of those wartime profits. They got that money. Like, they were not getting paid. So, like, I don't know if you remember, or Audie, I don't know if you've ever been to, like, the Henry Ford Museum.
I've been, yeah.
Okay. I don't know if you recall, they had, like, really uplifting, like, wartime production. We all pitched in together to stop the Nazis, you know, like, all that.
Yeah, they got the 40-style newsreel. They got, like, all the... And basically, the Henry Ford Museum, if we really want to get into it, is kind of, like, this kitschy Americana collection that, like, obscures what, you know, the Ford Motor Company really got away with that we're talking about today. Kind of just gets to paint them as all-American, like apple pie and hot dogs, basically.
And, like, what's staggering, too, is that, like, they had, like, the U.S. government basically had to force them at the barrel of a gun to go into wartime production. They did not want to. They didn't do it willingly. They delivered shitty products. They were, you know, profiteering off of this shit. Like, it is staggering, the insane levels of, like, just lies about what went down during World War II, which is supposed to be the time when America is supposed to be, like, you know, happy, feel-good time, you know, we're all fighting the evil enemy. And it's like, well, the top employers in the area weren't fighting. And in fact, they were actively collaborating with the fucking Nazis before, during, and after.
Oh, certainly not. And, like, this is all bringing to light that one MLK quote. I think this is on, he was speaking in, I forget which speech it was. I think it was the To America speech, but basically, like, the bombs we drop in Vietnam are the same ones we drop at home.
Mm-hmm.
This is basically, like, the framework for it. Once again, first as tragedy, then as farce.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's just, like, ridiculous. And, like, all this stuff, okay, we can sit here and say something like, I love the example, like, cars are fascist. And it's like, history literally absolves you. Like, you are right when you say that. Like, it's fucking fascism, man.
And it's like, and it's not even like, oh, this happened in the 70s, but it stopped and cars are equitable now. I refuse to believe that for a minute, right? Where it's like, systemic racism has been fueled by not just white flight after the riots, but also, like, using the proliferation of the sale of private automobiles to wean people off of public transit, use it to justify cutting public transit, and keeping, you know, the cities more and more separate from the suburbs, right? So it further, you know, justifies these racialized myths that are created post-riots.
And then you also end up getting fed bullshit. Like, if you don't have a car, you're a scrub.
Yeah, if you don't have a car, you're, you know, you're a waste man, you're a scrub. Cars are increasing. I've talked to Heavenly Spit on Twitter about this. This came up in a discussion we had where it's like the petrol economy and then by extension the automobile becomes this like symbol of individualism. It becomes like even like these stupid op-ed articles you'll see defending private automobile ownership over public transit. They bring up these hackneyed ideas of like cars as freedom. And that too, like if you take a look at the cost of owning an automobile, right? Not only do you have to, one, purchase or lease the car itself, and in whatever case you might be, you might have to finance it. You're also stuck then with like anything like registration and title fees. You're stuck with insurance. And in the case of the state of Michigan, auto insurance is at some of the highest rates in the country, disproportionately affecting, you know, working class and people in poverty broadly, right? And you're already like basically telling these people, nah, fuck you, there's no public transit if you can't afford a car. You got to take on the debt to own a vehicle. And guess what? Now here we are once again. You're sticking people with debt and payments.
Yeah.
Oftentimes just to buy a shitty car. Not even one that works or is safe.
On top of that, I mean, a car looms about as prominently in the American psyche as guns do. And like,
yeah,
but like more and more, like these are like reifying systems too, because like serial killers love cars and they are abetted in their crimes by having cars. And it's a power fantasy. And we're seeing more and more that, like, people are just running into people with cars, like, using them directly as weapons. Like, we saw that, you know, in those protests and...
Charlottesville, yeah.
I was watching that...
And then was it Florida or Texas that was like, oh, we're going to let it be okay if you hit a protester with a car?
Yeah, no. Dude, I was watching that Charlottesville riot live when that fucking happened. I was freaking out in my apartment. But no, and so like basically like these things are like reifying, and then like so basically then it's like it strengthens your sense of identity that you have a car, and then like, you know, you're further atomized from other people, like and then like, yeah, like then people don't want to hitchhike or like, you know, whatever, because there's like, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's like it pretty much re-emphasizes, again, it's like I think people get caught up sometimes in like, was this by design or like more subtly did this end up getting engineered, right? But like we're in an increasingly individualistic and atomized society. The broadest societal message that we have is one of fuck you, you're on your own. You can't really help people. And in fact, if you do, you might get hurt for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when it comes to like your independence, you're only as independent as far as your money can take you.
Mm-hmm.
Which again, in the cost of owning a vehicle, I didn't even mention fuel costs.
Yeah, exactly. And then like, oh, gosh, you end up needing to support politics that support low, like, cost of fuel just to not completely screw over your own economic interests. Like they really have like a gun to your head now in terms of like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. And it's like, again, not to digress once again, but it's like when people take a look at this problem of automobiles, the immediate solution we're pushing to people is like, what if we have the same system, but we're like stripping Bolivia of all its land cover for batteries instead of gas?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of maybe fundamentally re-examining, hey, is this fucking necessary?
Yeah, exactly.
So, and this doesn't even, I mean, we should probably get into the further point here, right? Which is that, yes, the auto industry is this major economic sector that provides significant employment to many people across the country, and then specifically in the Metro Detroit area. But to keep that, to keep production running, you got to have a workforce that stops asking questions. So there's some additional topics I'm researching at this time. There's even like unique angles where there's like black unions being formed specifically to protest like the most dangerous jobs being done by black auto workers. But as a whole, you know, we have, specifically in the UAW's case, Walter P. Reuther coming in to heighten this contradiction of the exploitation of the auto industry with it being quote unquote stable work, to organize unions, putting out some of the most effective strikes, and just the very effective slogan of unionism, not Fordism. But in addition to Ford's Nazi ties, we have to also connect the fact that, you know, some of these strikes were put down or resisted with the help of organized crime.
That's right.
So specifically, I'm going to cite this one case from Carr's book. I'm going to, he gets into a little bit of mob history that is probably a lot more better put than what you can find. Some of this is hard to find, but in the Ford case, he talks about the Nazi connections, and then he also, to find the page, god dang it. Let's see, the Detroit mob families, Rise of Jimmy Hoffa, that's not the one. Henry Ford's henchman, there we go. So, you ever hear this guy named Harry Bennett?
No, I don't think so.
So, Harry Bennett was basically one of Henry Ford's most trusted and infamous confidants, and is this basically like, he's both mobbed up as well as being like something of like a boxer himself. And because of this, you know, ability to one, like call in favors with organized crime as well as like physically do the beating up, you know, Henry Ford starts admiring the guy and keeps him on hand. So specifically, as described in conversation, he liked to drop the names of gangsters like Chet Lamar. Lamar was a mob boss who had provided the Ford Rouge plant with vegetables as a front for his crime activity, and was known as the King of Hamtramck before someone murdered him in his West Side home. In contrast to the thuggish image he cultivated, Bennett's wardrobe was more Harry Truman than Al Capone. Not that anyone was going to tell him to his face that no bow ties look a tad nerdy. He wore them because he wasn't going to wear a necktie that could become a noose if an enemy grabbed it. So, specifically in the chapter, I think he mentions that, like, there was this event called the Battle of the Overpass where the UAW was protesting or striking. Walter Reuther was present at this strike and was basically tossed down a couple flights of stairs for passing pamphlets. And Bennett was doing Ford's bidding with goons and fisticuffs on May 26, 1937, Battle of the Overpass. Basically, the strikers are pushing for a shorter workday and a heftier paycheck from $6 to $8 a day. And basically, Bennett gets caught beating up strikers by a journalist and chases down the journalist to like delete the prints or like have them destroyed. And another thing that Carr gets into in this chapter is like, by many popular accounts, both of his homes reflected his mob-like persona and a life of opulent and paranoid excess. So one of the homes, the Geddes Roadhouse between Ann Arbor and Ipsy, known as Bennett's Castle, reportedly featured tunnels to where he kept pet lions and tigers. He entertained guests in tiled Roman baths and defended the picturesque grounds with a gun tower.
The world is yours.
At his other home near the small town of Farwell, northwest of Clare, so that's like further north in the state, visitors spoke of an interrogation room with a single bench and steel hoops embedded in the wall, perhaps to shackle someone being questioned. The home had a swimming pool, a bar with a window looking out to the underwater portion of the pool, so he and male guests could have a lecher's eye view underwater of women swimming in the pool. So just a classy guy, just one of the guys over here.
Like, this is real gangster shit. Like, this is, like, wild. And, like,
this guy, Henry Ford, he's hanging out with made men.
He was, yeah. And, like, I've been reading a lot of this this academic, Alan Block, who argues that, like, there are certainly formations of organized crime that exist outside of heavy industry, but organized crime and heavy industry are so intertwined as to basically almost be like working hand in hand with each other. And you see that in so many cases. Like, basically, I mean, you see it in The Sopranos, right? I mean, basically they go and like beat up some striking workers at one point. Like, they, like union busting is like one of the main jobs of the mafia. And then like the titans of industry will like allow them small monopolies to like keep them around for when they really need them, which is to like go bust some heads now and again.
Yeah. And I think like, again, that connection is worth noting. Like, again, people will probably dismiss this like, oh, here go these conspiracy theorists talking about the mob and anti-union activity. Mm-hmm. But you need to bring up these connections because organized crime can do things for you that you don't want to admit to doing specifically, that you can have plausible deniability for, or quite frankly, you don't have the stomach to do, right? You know, you get hired at Ford Motor Company, not for your ability to beat people up. You get hired, assume it was allegedly for your business acumen. So that's how I'll put it. So to bring up this larger point, right, is that if they're not infiltrating the unions, they are suppressing it. There's even like instances of like some of the organized crime networks in Gladio, for instance, in Italy, being the same ones used to like harass and intimidate striking port and dock workers, so to speak. Right? So it's not for nothing that organized crime exists within or near the nexus of industry and right-wing politics. I think they play a role in maintaining legitimate forms of capitalism, and then specifically they are like, we will be the guys who take the proceeds from the quote-unquote invisible market. Not to say that that's like, you know, they all met in a smoke-filled room and did that, but functionally that's the role they play, you know?
And then they actually do also. Like,
exactly.
It's both. Like, these relationships go on, and like oftentimes people end up inheriting these relationships, but then they continue to meet in those rooms and perpetuate those relationships.
This was part two of our Sus Michigan episode featuring Jimmy Fallon Gong. Jimmy runs a great podcast called Program to Chill that I encourage you to check out. I'll have links to the show in the description below, as well as our links to our social media as well. Thanks again for tuning in, dear listener. Take care.